This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
Now, it is a Wednesday. It means we have a Power Boardroom. We've spent some time really speaking about some very important topical issues within South Africa's economic landscape. Now, we know that economic integration is not new to the African continent. The African Continental Free Trade Area Agreement, which came into effect in January 2021, is the world's largest new free trade area since the establishment of the World Trade Organization. That was back in 1994. Now, it is expected to facilitate intra-African trade and improve the competitiveness of African industries and enterprises. So while there's been a great momentum and we've all seen it behind this agreement, its successful implementation still depends on thoughtful policy choices. So in this conversation, we'll look at the role of regional economic communities in implementing the African Continental Free Trade Area Agreement and explore what lessons can be drawn from previous regional economic integration experiences. When we speak about regional economic communities, we're speaking of the likes of ECOWAS, for instance. That's the Economic Community of West African States, or COMESA, the Common Market for Eastern and Southern Africa. SADC, we speak about SADC often as a SADC country. That's the Southern African Development Community, or the EAC there, and that really is looking at East Africa. Now, we know that is actually seen as the one of the most successful ones, regional economic communities out there. Joining us to have this conversation, I am joined by Cindy Sondlovu, Acting Head of Political Economic Research and Analysis at the Export Credit Insurance Corporation of South Africa, as well as Victor Gomeswana, African Business Specialist and author of Africa is Open for Business. Good evening to you both, and thank you so much for your time.
Good evening, Nalutando. Thank you for the welcome.
Wonderful, Asini. So I think we're still waiting for Victor to come online. So maybe we can go ahead and shoot here about, you know, when we talk about these regional economic communities within the African context, what exactly do we refer to in terms of the benefits that flow within the regions?
Okay, just to give maybe just a background, I'll just elaborate on some of, you know, the regs. That's what I prefer to call them, because that's what
regs,
them in short, yes. We call them the regs as an REC. So I think recognizing that obviously as a continent, there's quite a lot of bodies. So it was a good starting point to actually use those, because it narrowed down the scope if you look at it, where we started with 18 regional groupings and were only focused on the 8. So that integration already is a step in the positive direction, because if you're working with smaller groups, then, you know, you're obviously eating the elephant in bite-sized pieces. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you look at the broader continent, the groupings are actually called spaghetti, because there is quite a lot of overlap that you see within the groups. So I think that was a first positive step to actually break them down into the broader 8 groups and use those 8 groups as pillars to actually build the integration of the continent on. And then obviously stemming from that is some commonalities that we see in terms of, you know, social, in terms of economies, in terms of existing relationships that are already there in the 8 regional groupings.
And thank you for painting that picture for us. I do believe that Victor has joined us. Victor, good evening. Thank you for being with us this evening. Cindy and I were just touching on the matter of RECs, as she calls them. These are regional economic communities within the African continent. And I'd asked her, you know, how she thinks they've worked well. The regions have worked well. I'm wondering if you'd like to weigh in.
Good evening, Nolutando, and to Cindy as well. I heard some of the points she made about the regional economic communities. Think about it this way. In Johannesburg, you have Soweto on the south, southwest, but you also have suburbs, you know, the southern suburbs. If you are to organize Johannesburg or Pretoria, it's easier to say Mamelodi, Silverton, Eastland, get grouped together and organize yourselves neighborhood watch style, because you have some things in common. You face similar challenges. You have some shared history. And if you think about the borders of Africa, because they were not created by Africans, they would have divided communities that probably belonged together. So if you start with regional economic communities, yes, the logic is you allow people who have more in common with one another and already might have collaborated on certain or in certain projects to work together. And maybe once they have overcome those obstacles amongst themselves or removed the barriers, they can then have the regional economic communities working amongst themselves. That's how the African Union will be a success in the end. And I'm sure you might have heard a few months ago, after being elected, President William Ruto of Kenya saying something very profound. He said, we are no longer going to, as African leaders, attend these European or American or Asian meetings as individual heads of state. You know the joke about African heads of state going to the royal wedding or to the funeral and being thrown into a bus where they are used to traveling in their own. It might just sound like a joke, but it's actually exactly that. They, when you are in Europe, they look at you as just another African country. And if you don't have the unified voice of the African Union member states, or at least the East African community, or the Southern African Development Community, or the Economic Community of West African States, then you just become a small player. Sure. But by grouping together as members of the same regional economic communities, then you are beginning to have a unified voice. You can allow the might of the regions to prevail. Just to close the opening remark, the East African community now stands at over 200 million people, and it's not even 10 countries. That makes it a much more formidable force. If it is joined by Ethiopia, which has over 100 million people, it then has over 300 million people as a market. It's a lot easier for it to bargain than for Rwanda, which is a member state, to go with 12 million population to negotiate an export deal or a trade deal, because it doesn't have the muscle of a 300 million bloc. Economic Community of West African States, 15 states or so, also over 300 million. And the same with Southern African Development Community, also about 15 states, over 100, 300 million. If you divide it like that, then the 1.3 billion Africans are a lot easier to manage and to represent in international trade.
Thank you for painting that picture for us, Victor, because the next question that I'd like to ask is about, you know, outside of the population sizes, are we seeing the RICS work together in ways that really do bring some sort of a shared value, you know, trade integration, productive integration, macroeconomic integration? Are we seeing all of these? And of course, it might vary from one region to another, and maybe that is some important insight to get.
Yes, it is important. For example, SADC, I know, has been focusing a lot on, and I mean, this is something you can talk to somebody like the governor of the Reserve Bank. They have been working a lot on their banking systems for their ability to be able to transfer money. You know, when you are paying Cindy So, who is a Swati national, and you are using different currencies, there are so many steps involved. They generate an invoice in one currency, they send it to you, you must translate and determine how much you owe them, and then you must buy her currency, or maybe buy a US dollar, and then you must translate them into her currency. And so it becomes very difficult. Whereas if you work your banking systems, that she can send you an invoice in dollars, and you can pay in South African rand, or she can generate something in Naira, Nigerian Naira, and you can pay in Naira from your own credit card or from your own bank card, is a lot easier. That I know, the clearing systems for the banks in SADC has been a big issue. In East Africa, I'll use a different example. They have one visa policy that allows somebody to get a visa to go to Tanzania, for example. If they are tourists, they're able to get one visa and visit Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda, and not have to apply for visa at different places, just as you would have expected, because in the end, tourism is a regional experience. The Economic Community of West African States even attempted a common currency, which they launched, called the ECO. Mm-hmm. I just don't know how well it's doing, but they're still working on their borders. And that's the most complex of all the economic communities or regional economic communities, because it's got the Portuguese, the French, the Spanish, the English, and a whole lot of other. And the cultural differences are a lot more. So although in terms of area, it doesn't cover as much area and as many countries maybe as SADC, but it's a lot more diversified and it could be difficult. But I'm seeing that a lot more. I'm sure you saw Namibia and Botswana agreeing that if you are a Botswana national or a Namibian and you want to visit either of the countries, you can use your national ID as a passport. Those are some of the collaborations that are making traveling more practical. Remember, Nolutando, when intra-Africa trade is going to eventually work is when you can do two things. You can make the movement of goods across borders a lot easier, smoother, and duty-free, and you can make the movements of people across borders a lot more trouble-free. If you get those two things right, then you have intra-Africa trade.
Wonderful, Victor. Cindy, so I'm keen to also get your, you know, your thoughts on what Victor has just said, specifically around, you know, the movement of goods, of people as well, maybe with the ECIC, with goods. Are we seeing the ease of it becoming more prevalent, you know? We know that, of course, 10 years ago, it could be more difficult, but today it could be easier. And in 10 years' time, it could be even easier. Are we seeing that trend?
Thanks, Nolutando. I think as Victor has said, I just want to echo his comment that we must, at this point in time, consider the successes that we have seen in East Africa. There's quite a lot of positive things that they're doing. Even when they look at their transportation plan, they are no longer looking at it in isolation. I think one of the developments that we have seen is obviously the development of the Tanzania railway line, where countries such as the DRC can access goods, you know, from the Dar es Salaam port right through. So we see them looking at a picture where you are not just looking at, you know, movement, you're looking at movement of goods as well as people from one country to the next seamlessly. So hence, when we collaborate on those levels and goods are able to move and people are able to move from one country to the next, I think one of the successes as well, just to touch on the issue of the currencies, Afri-Exim Bank has come up with the PAP system where they hope to create a platform for countries to actually trade. That in itself is expected to save the continent over $5 billion. I think Victor did say that, you know, you can imagine how hard it is to transfer money just from a neighboring country. We're not even talking countries that are far. Those are countries that are already within the rand monetary area. Yet you find that there is so many processes, the clearance times are longer. So that's one of the successes, I think, you know, obviously leveraging on the banking system, on the technology that is already there. Ourselves as the ECIC, we are more focused on actually things such as infrastructure investment, which is of supporting that movement that you see across the different borders. We've participated in a number of projects where we're looking at, you know, improvement and road rehabilitation projects, port developments, and one of our flagship projects that we're currently working on now with South African banks. We use the term SA Inc., where we're collaborating to go together with the financiers, because as the ECIC, we offer insurance. So we're working with South African lenders as well as DFIs such as the IDC and DBSA. And I think one of those projects that, you know, we really raised the flag high was obviously the development of Bay Bridge border post rehabilitation, recognizing obviously that a lot of the countries that are within SADC are landlocked, and to allow, you know, for quicker processing times, because one of the issues that has been highlighted as a deterrent is the movement, the actual cost. If you look at bureaucracy, the paperwork, the time that it takes for clearance systems, the lack of coordination, which I think Victor has already highlighted, that East Africa, you have one paper, you declare across, you don't have to go at every stop, complete the same paperwork, which we flag as a success at this moment.
It's very interesting what we're hearing about the East African region. And Victor, I'd like you both and Sinizo to help us, you know, besides what we've spoken about already here with, you know, the East African countries coming together and being able to really see real integration. What could it be about the temperament or maybe the priorities of the governments that see this happen? Because a lot of it sometimes is just political will. It's the ability for, you know, for instance, our president here to call the president of Botswana and the president of Namibia to sit down and to have very difficult conversations. So I'm wondering what it is they're getting right from that perspective that other regions may not be getting as right.
By the way, we must also give credit, before I just answer that question, Olutando, we must give credit to the likes of the ECIC, because the anxiety of exporting or of exporting goods to a country you don't know can be a deterrent in business. Yes. And to have an agency of the government or an entity of the government come in to de-risk that cross-border trade is something we must not take for granted. It's a highly commendable initiative, what the ECIC is doing. In fact, the very existence of the ECIC must be commended, and I wish that the intra-Africa collaboration could, among other things, extend to that cross-border insurance, because I don't think that other countries have an equivalent agency or at least something that has achieved the level of development that the ECIC has achieved. It's just that because they are not a retail agency, they don't get talked about as much. But what the reason the countries find it difficult to collaborate, Nolutando, it's a trade-off that's very difficult. If you want to do duty-free trade, it means you forgo customs or import duties for volume of trade. So I'll try and illustrate it. The Bay Bridge Border Post, which is a very good example of what countries can do to collaborate to create that seamless movement of goods. If I am in just north of the Zimbabwe-South Africa border and I would like to come into South Africa to stay at an hotel overnight, let's say in Musina, and I can do it without paying a visa fee. Visa could end up being, say, maybe $70 or $50, whatever it is. But instead of paying $50, the South African government says, I'll let you in so you can come in with ease and stay at my hotel. You'll probably pay 1,000 rand per night, and you will eat at the restaurant. You'll give tips to the waiters and waitresses. You will tip the people parking your car. You will fill up petrol. You will go to a restaurant. You'll go to a garages and buy something. You'll probably buy some artworks and curios on your way back. So instead of trying to prioritize the $70 or $50 or $30 in visa fees, we're going to make it easier for you to come in here and spend a lot more money. If we have a casino, you'll spend even more money. If we've got a game park, you'll spend even more money. And chances are you might be tempted to not go back home. So it's that trade-off that says, I will give up the import duty, the visa fees, because I believe by allowing movement, there will be a lot more trading happening, and I will benefit from the actual volume of trade, the job creation, the spin-offs, but also I will generate from generating VAT, I will benefit from creating a chance of people thinking of my country as a hospitable place and coming again. If they were coming on business, they will bring families on holiday, and vice versa. If they were coming on holiday, they might meet business partners. But if you make moving through the borders difficult, not only are you losing the opportunity to have those kinds of spin-offs, but you also create an opportunity for corrupt officials to say, I'll let you through if you'll give me $70. Or I'll let you through if you do this and that for me. That way you create that underground economy that nobody benefits from. And of course, you make your country a lot more difficult. So it's about the country's understanding. It's a lot more attractive to forego the taxes at the borders and generate more revenue within the economy and get economic growth going, and probably generate other forms of taxes like VAT from all kinds of transactions that will happen once people are inside the country.
Got you, Victor. Cindy, so from your perspective, you know, when we think of goods, for instance, moving, you know, across borders, what are some of the anxieties here, you know, that are coming through in terms of that? I think Victor mentioned that, you know, there's a de-risking process that happens here, of course, as an insurer, and that's definitely. But when your clients come to you, when they think of, for instance, moving something from South Africa to another part of the continent, what are key concerns that you hear about?
Thanks, Nolutando. I think one of the issues that is very prevalent is the issue of, you know, civil war and disturbances, because the opportunities might be there, but you have your goods moving across different jurisdictions. So there is sometimes that level of instability. And as Victor said, when people think of Africa, they think it's one big country. So if anything happens at the tip, even if it's something that is in Cape Town, you get somebody who is not aware of, you know, the geography of the continent thinking that is an event that is happening even in Central Africa. Mm-hmm. So I think the issue of obviously civil war, instability that we see, there's also some concerns. I think we must acknowledge that on the continent, because of the different currencies that we have, there is a lot of exchange rate volatility in terms of the concerns that people have to say, will I get payment for my goods? And if I do get it, will the currency that I have be a currency that I can utilize? So those are some of the concerns that people have. And obviously, when we talk trade, we cannot talk trade without trust. So it's that level of element to say, will I get repayments for my goods? Because when we talk trade, we always think that it's not always money that is readily available. Some of these exporters actually have to go to banks, get a loan, fund. If you have a big order, you might need the likes of working capital to be able to execute the export order. So will I be able to repay the loan that I got from the bank as well? Mm-hmm. You know, will my goods arrive at my destination? Will they not at some point maybe be taken by somebody? Or if we were looking at the bigger scheme of things with some of the projects that we cover at ECIC, some of the risk will spill over to events such as expropriation. Will government not take, you know, my investment away, or nationalization, whatever form is there? As well as breaches. I mean, we are talking cross-border investments and movements. It's one investor that's setting up a plant. You agree on terms with the government when the project starts, because everyone is welcome for business, and people want to establish businesses on the continent to create jobs and have, you know, all the things that come with it. But you're set in the country, you are established. Will you still get the same hand that welcomed you in and allow you, if you had exemptions for certain things, if you had allowances for certain things? So we also cover things such as, you know, breaches that might be there from the host government, but that obviously is applicable to the more, you know, bigger investments that we see, rather than to the normal trade finance that we see, you know, on a daily basis.
Thank you for that, Cindy. So I'd like to come back now to the RECs themselves and just trying to figure out, Victor, maybe we can come back to you here. With regards to, for instance, the EAC trading with SADC, trading with ECOWAS, how far or close are we to seeing this happening seamlessly?
Yeah, we might want to speak to the African Continental Free Trade Area Secretariat, because there are many instruments that have to be activated. The key thing, I believe, are what they call competent authorities. I think they call them competent authorities. Mm-hmm. Agencies like the revenue authorities, because those are the ones that must exempt you from the kind of duties that would be payable. And the ability to issue a certificate to trade across borders must be issued after capacity would have been built within the different countries. I remember somebody in Tanzania celebrating the issuing of an AFTA certificate, as they call it, And it sounded like quite a groundbreaking achievement, because I don't think the practical trading movement of goods is something that we have the capacity yet, or we have built enough capacity. Mm-hmm. Because remember, for you to allow somebody to trade duty-free means you are confident that they are not breaching intellectual property, they are not trading goods that are not meant for that market. Remember, there are things called parallel grey goods that could have been imported elsewhere duty-free already, meant for one market, but they get redirected to another. All these things are about capacity, and that capacity at the moment of the state in general in Africa needs a lot of work. And so I would say at least the policies are there, they are signed, we can say we have started implementing. There are all sorts of tools that are being created, like the one Cindy so mentioned with the Afrexim Bank, the African Development Bank is also involved. But I would say once we have the competent authorities in the individual countries able to issue the kind of certificates that will allow the trade, we will still be a bit far off.
Got you. Thank you. I'd like us to quickly head over to Power News Headlines, and when we return, we'll wrap up our conversation. Brian Letsibondi is on standby.
Power Business with Nolu Thando and Thonthi Mlambo, Monday to Thursday, 6 to 8 p.m. and Fridays, 6 to 7 p.m. on Power 98.7.
19:35 on Power Business. As we edge closer to 8 p.m., we are still in our Power boardroom speaking to Cindy Sondlovu, Acting Head of Political Economic Research and Analysis at the Export Credit Insurance Corporation of South Africa, more popularly known as the ECIC, as well as Victor Khomeswana, who's an African business specialist and author of Africa is Open for Business. We are speaking about regional economic communities and how they could help us, you know, get the right learnings to inform the African Continental Free Trade Area Agreement. And before we went to headlines, Victor had spoken to us about capacity building and also competent authorities having to be in place in order for us to realize this future. Cindy, so I'm wondering from your perspective, you know, as you work in this space, you know, from Victor's thought of competent authorities, are we building them and at the right pace?
In terms of that, really, as he has mentioned, I think the key is a partnership. That's how I'd want us to look at this, because we might have the authorities, but are we also making the message or taking the message out there as government? I think one of the collaborations as the ECIC through the DTIC, we are trying to, you know, have various programs so that there is quite a lot of awareness, because I think capacitating officials also has to come from inquiries that are coming through, so that we make sure that the people that are standing there to be able to guide the exporters to say, these are the desks that are there, either at the DTIC or at South African Revenue Services, to be able to direct people and point them in the right direction. And I think key to that also is making sure that there is quite a lot of involvement. It was very interesting during the negotiations when people were signing the agreement for accession that I saw that, except I think for Nigeria, there was quite a lot of dialogue which was there. They were having roadshows in different provinces and, I mean, counties in Nigeria, which would be equivalent to the provinces, getting their buy-in. So I don't think it's fair to just put one hand of the stick out and say, what are the other authorities competent? But this has to be looked at as, you know, the authorities are there. There is an enabling environment. But on the side of exporters as well, is the are we as the government creating awareness? Is the message getting home? Are people even aware sitting? Is an exporter that's sitting somewhere in Limpopo aware that, you know, there is this agreement that is there? I can leverage on its existence. I can sell across. You know, I just need this and that in terms of the paperwork.
So I must then ask you, you know, as we edge closer to the end of our conversation, Victor, from your perspective, will we be able to realize the free trade area agreement within our time, in our time? Or is this something that we can, you know, build the foundation for right now for it to be realized in future?
Well, I don't play for postponing or laying the foundation. Mm-hmm. We have been laying the foundation for a long time. Mm-hmm. It's something we should be able to realize. Mm-hmm. Luckily, intra-Africa trade is not a one-size, is it is not a one all or nothing kind of of play. It is already happening. There are lots of border posts in Africa that are one-stop border posts. Chirundu border post between Zimbabwe and Zambia. That already facilitates trade. And I think Rwanda has about five already one-stop border posts. One-stop border posts are relevant because they allow you to stop at only one point and check your papers rather than check, stop on the South African side and then stop on the Zimbabwean side, or stop on the South African side and then stop on the Lesotho side, because that's where the time is lost and often room for bribery is created. So already it is happening. As you know, it's not just trade, it's also trade and investment. And if you look at companies like MTN, companies like Standard Bank, you know, these are companies that are doing business all over the continent, which means already there's a lot of intra-Africa trade. What needs to happen, of course, is the removal of the of most of the duties so that the goods can be affordable. If you try and go to a country like Uganda and you try and go to a ShopRite, when I went there, I was shocked at the prices. Part of the reason, explanation, ShopRite, which is often affordable in South Africa, was so expensive. And I remember the same thing in Angola. It's because of the import duties. And, and again, it's not just the actual import duties. It's what we call non-tariff barriers. And that's corruption. All sorts of things that end up creating obstacles and making the cost of doing business much, much higher. So it is happening already. At the moment, I think, and Simiswa can maybe discuss that further because she's a researcher, but it's still measured at under 20% of the total volume of African exports. In other words, less than 20% going to other African countries. In regions like Asia, where there's real intra-regional trade, they are over, most of them are over 50%, or some are even over 55%. So that's, it's a continuum. It's not something that we are going to be zero and then we have 100. We are moving and increasing that percentage or share of intra-Africa trade amongst ourselves, but it's already happening. We just have to expedite it, accelerate it.
Gotcha. And Sinisa, would you like to weigh in on this final question?
Yes, Nalutando. I think just to highlight some of the issues that Victor has already mentioned, there's an approach which they have adopted if you look at the bigger picture. Yes, we acknowledge that the levels are still very low, he's right. We're currently estimated to be in the region of 15.5%. So as you may appreciate, that is quite significant, because if you look at it, it means we are in the region of close to 80% plus of goods that we're getting from rest of the world. So that's still quite a significant portion. So in terms of the targets, they have obviously set targets for different commodities. They've got a section that they're allocating for agriculture and food products, where they're almost looking at 10% increase, as well as industrial products and other energy and mining products. So that is how they are scaling it down, so that, you know, we get the small wins, because trade is already happening on the continent. But we just want to unify and recognize ourselves and allow for the easy movement of, obviously, goods and people across borders. And just to touch on what Victor said in terms of, you know, the successes, it's very interesting because we actually pulled out a comparison that was done from research papers in terms of the learning points that are they getting successes from both the EU as well as Asia. Asia managed to triple its trade in 10 years. Between, I think, in 1995 and 2012, it tripled. But if you look at the key things, the regions just looked at what they could do better. So there is quite, you know, stark differences that you see there, where the EU is more focused, was more focused on, you know, unity of vision. And then you get France and Germany being the main centers of power and higher levels of cultural identity. But even then, for the EU, it took them quite some time. If we were to just look back at the data, I think they developed their a customs union in 1968, and they only moved, I think, to a single market round about 93, and to a common currency close to 2000, which was about 1999. And yet, if you look at Asia, they were also equally successful, but their model has got, you know, at that point in time when they started, there was no leading nation, but now we get obviously China assuming that role. There is low levels of cultural identity, and they have obviously, they utilize a competitive advantage to enable, you know, promotion of trade and investments. So they use a model that's based on, you know, the diverse economic participants. So I think it's a matter of us on the continent finding what works for us. And I think we must give credit to S.G. Wamgele and his team. There is quite a lot of streamlining that needs to be done in the processes. And as Victor has said, we are already there. I think it's just a matter of clarifying, unpacking things and identifying the priorities. The voice of competition that is there, it's very important, I think, to communicate. As you said, there is also a lot of fears from smaller economies that obviously rely on customs duties. But I think if you look at the agreement as a whole, they do accommodate the smaller economies. They do have, you know, instruments that allow for tariff concessions over, you know, up to 2030, up to 2035, where they gradually build in those things and allow them to benefit for that duration. There's also categories for sensitive goods as well that allow time for the smaller economies to come in. So I think there is progress that's being made. It's a matter of trying to see how we can collaborate as a continent and work together. And I liked one of the statements, I think, that was said in South Africa at the tourism Indaba, I think, for this year. One of the spokespersons there said, this next year when we come to Durban for this forum, we're no longer looking at South Africa. When someone comes to visit the continent, we want them to come to South Africa, go to Zambia, go to Zimbabwe. We need to see African countries also becoming part of this. So for me, it starts with that, having a common voice. We do not want to have competing interests. I saw an article recently where, you know, there is mention of South Africa having competitive advantage for manufacturing. So they stand to gain more, they'll get 1.46 billion, and this will cost Nigeria 148 million. So it's those competing voices that are still there. You know, we must look at ourselves holistically. We must see how we can uplift each other, and we must see the gaps that we can close.
Well, I'd like to thank you both for your time this evening. A really invaluable conversation, and I hope we can keep discussing this until we see, you know, this agreement working the way that we all dream of it to work. Thank you so much. That is Victor Home Swana, Africa Business Specialist and author of Africa's Open for Business, as well as Cindy Sondlovu, Acting Head of Political Economic Research and Analysis at the Export Credit Insurance Corporation of South Africa. Now,
you've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.